Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host Douglas Impuga in Washington. Here are some of the top stories we're covering on this Thursday, March 6, 2025. South Sudan Forces commander who was trapped in their forces barracks is expected to be flown out of Nasir town soon.
Yesterday evening, there was a team that came from Juba. Those of units, they were trying to pick the general, and so the general had failed to be picked from the barracks in the town that we evacuated.
Displaced health workers offer their services at the Sudan Mobile Health Center.
We provide service for more than 200 patients per day. This for patient visit our clinic, and also provide nutritional survey for patient inside camp and surrounding village.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudan People's Defense Forces commander who was trapped in the forces barracks after the White Army captured Nasir this week is expected to be flown out of the town soon. Officials say some SSPDF soldiers were airlifted to Malakal and Bor Thursday afternoon. Mama Abraham Kuwait reports for VOA from Juba.
Commander David Majurdak with the South Sudan People's Defense Forces in Nasir is expected to be flown to Malakal on a helicopter from the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS. Senior government officials and aid workers in Malakal confirmed Thursday that 10 SSPDF soldiers were flown to Malakal and another helicopter will be sent to pick the commander who has been trapped in a military tank since Tuesday. Gwanar Deng, acting Nasir County Health Director, says the county commissioner has been coordinating to airlift out the commander.
Yesterday evening, there was a team that came from Juba. Those of UNMISS, they were trying to pick the general, and so the general had failed to be picked from the barracks in the town that we evacuated. So now the commissioner has a discussion from Juba to discuss this issue, how to get this general from that town.
Fighting between the White Army militia and the SSPDF forces began over the weekend in Nasir County in Upper Nile State. Deng says the death toll from the conflict has risen to 70 White Army members and 199 wounded. However, casualties from the military in Nasir are not clear.
I received two dead bodies and one wounded today. And yesterday, I got 98 wounded. And the day before yesterday, I received 100 wounded. So, for really, I'm not sure because some of the dead bodies, they remain in the barrack. But the total that I received from the different facilities, they were 70.
Deng says the wounded have been taken to Akobo and that the final casualty numbers will be confirmed when the SSPDF commander has been airlifted out. The SPLMIO spokesperson Pal Mai Deng told journalists that First Vice President Riek Machar spoke with the White Army to ask it to allow the commander to be airlifted to Juba. Some SPLMIO officials in Juba were arrested Tuesday after the White Army took control of the SSPDF barracks in Nasir. Among those arrested were the SSPDF Deputy Chief of Staff Gabriel Duop Lam and the National Minister for Petroleum, Port Kang Chol. In addition, SSPDF soldiers now are surrounding Machar's home. Mai expresses concern over the arrest of SPLMIO senior officials.
The SPLMIO is bearing my concern with the arbitrary arrest of its senior government officials and military commanders. We had the chief of SSPDF and acting general chief of staff, General Duop, arrested, who is also the co-chair of JDB. And then following his detention and arrest, arbitrarily, Honorable Fort, the Minister of Petroleum, was also arrested at 2 a.m. in the morning. Honorable Port was arrested with other seven members.
South Sudan's Minister for Information says the White Army is loyal to the SPLM, SPLAIO, the armed unit of the opposition group. He says the SPLMIO should order the White Army to stand down and withdraw from the Nasir barracks to allow the stranded SSPDF personnel to leave. The SPLM SPLAIO has said it was not involved in the fighting in Nasser. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, which brokered the 2018 peace agreement, says it will send a high-level delegation to Nasser to assess the situation. IGAD Executive Secretary Wakini Jebeyeo says the recent clashes in Nasser may pose a risk to the revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan. In a joint statement, the embassies of Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, the United Kingdom and the United States, along with the European Union delegation, condemned the violence in Upper Nile State. The statement also expressed concern over the detention of senior SPLM-SPLAIO officials and called for an immediate end to hostilities. For VOA News, I am Amir Ibrahim Kouad, reporting from Juba.
South Sudan's main opposition group says its members are in a state of panic as government security operatives intensify a crackdown, arresting senior officials and forcing others into hiding. The office of the first vice president, Riek Machar, has confirmed that the national minister of peace building, Stephen Park Wall, was arrested Thursday along with his bodyguards and a secretary in his office. For VOA News, Deng Guy Deng reports from Juba.
Pok Both Baluang is the acting press secretary in the office of First Vice President Riek Machar, who heads the SPLM-IO opposition group.
The national security decided to arrest the Minister of Peace Building and the Secretary General of the NTC, Honorable Stephen Parkul, from his office approximately around 2 p.m. He was arrested along with his private secretary, Mr. Julius Lack, plus two of his bodyguards.
Minister Park Wall is the third senior SPLM-AIO official to be detained. This week, government forces have detained the SPLM-AIO military commander, Gabriel Duop Lam, and the National Minister of Petroleum, Port Kang Cholt, who were arrested in Juba. Pal Mai Deng, the spokesperson of the SPLM-IO, condemned the arrests.
What has happened is not only the violations of the revitalized agreement on the resolutions of conflict in South Sudan. It's also violation of South Sudan constitution, because what we have in the constitution is that once you're going to be arrested, you must be notified of the reasons of your arrest. You have to be given arrest warrant, and even after your arrest, you have to appear before the court of law within 48 hours. This hasn't been done, which is completely against the concept of fairness, justice, and the rule of law. We're asking SPLMIG to release these senior officials and other members of SPLAIO who have been arrested without due process of law, as soon as possible.
At a news conference on Wednesday, Information Minister and Government Spokesperson Michael Makuei-Lueth confirmed the arrest, but did not say what was behind them or whether the detainees would face trial. Mai says the opposition members are being targeted in Juba and other states. He warned that the continued arbitrary arrest and intimidation of SPLM-AIO leaders endanger the peace agreement. Tensions between the ruling SPLM, led by President Salva Kiir, and the SPLM-IO, led by First Vice President Riek Machar, have stalled the implementation of the 2018 revitalized peace agreement. Each side has accused the other of violating the deal. The latest arrests follow a deadly clash on Monday in Nasser County between the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the White Army Militia, which reportedly resulted in multiple casualties. The government has accused SPLM-AIO leaders of collaborating with the militia, a charge the opposition denies. SPLM-AIO is urging the government to deploy the necessary unified forces, arguing civilians trust them more than government soldiers. But government officials say the unified forces cannot be deployed due to an arms embargo that has left them without weapons. The U.S. and several European embassies, along with the European Union delegation, have all condemned the violence in Upper Nile State and say they are concerned over the detentions of senior SPLM-AIO officials. For VOA News, I am Deng Guy Deng in Juba.
A South Sudan expert says the arrests this week of individuals affiliated with the country's revitalized peace agreement signifies a lack of confidence in the process. Brian Adeba is a senior policy advisor at the Sentry, an organization that seeks to disable multinational predatory networks benefiting from violent conflicts. He tells my colleague VOA's James Bache, both sides should pursue de-escalation to mitigate the rising tension.
Well, I think the peace process outlines a collegial decision-making on aspects of controversy between the parties that have signed it, that some members of the agreement are being arrested and detained does not really bode well for the peace agreement. It signifies lack of faith in the processes spelled out for decision-making and for conflict resolution in the spirit of the peace agreement.
The arrests, at least some of those arrests, are associated with the first vice president, Riek Machar. I'm thinking back to what happened when the civil war came between supporters of Kiir and Riek Machar.
I think it exacerbates the tensions between supporters of both parties, and it deserves significant attention from the guarantors of the peace agreement. And also, it calls for a de-escalation of hostilities, because right now what is happening, the backdrop to this is the overrunning of the base that houses SPDF, the Sudan South Sudanese Army contingent in the town of...
SSPDF, eh?
Yeah. SSPDF, which is, in the town of Nasir, which is in the Nuer community territory from which Riek Machar hails. And so de-escalation is something that should be pursued diligently to mitigate tensions. I think involving elders and respected members of the community would go a long way to bring down the tensions.
Brian, last week, I think the representative of the United Nations in South Sudan warned the officials there about the need to focus on the road to elections. Do you think this could be another roadblock?
I think this is not related to the election preparations. I think the elections are still a long way off, not very long way off. I would say it's a year off. There are processes that are required to create the mechanisms and the institutions to govern the elections. Those are still ongoing or behind schedule considerably. But what we have, this tension that is flaring up, is a result of the subnational violence that predominates across several areas in the country. So this is not an issue that is peculiar to Nasir alone. It has happened in Western Equatoria State. It has happened in Tonj. It's happening in many other jurisdictions. And the United Nations itself has warned severally that there is need to put in place mechanisms to contain this subnational violence, because this violence undermines the spirit of the peace agreement.
That's Brian Adeba, a senior policy advisor at the Sentry, an organization that seeks to disable multinational predatory networks benefiting from violent conflict. He was speaking to us from Ontario, Canada. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. And still to come, Sudan displaced health workers offer their services at mobile health centers after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
Some health workers displaced by the conflict in Sudan are offering their services at mobile health centers sponsored by Sudanese American Physician Association, or SAPA, a non-profit founded by Sudanese doctors in the U.S. Dr. Musa Abubakar Ibrahim works at a Sapa mobile clinic at the Mushagara IDP Camp B in Gadaref. He says the clinic faces challenges as it offers services to thousands of Sudanese families who fled the Khartoum and Omdurman when conflict broke out in Khartoum on April 15th of 2023.
We provide service for more than 200 patients per day. That's for patient visit our clinic. And also provide nutritional survey for patients inside camp and surrounding village.
And how many cases have you dealt with here that are quite severe, that needs a medical facility with modern technology? Because here, I just saw, basic.
Now the number of the patient is decreasing because most of the patient, they return back to their homes. Approximately about 15 to 20% of patients that need referral for further management that not provide here.
Where do you refer them to?
Most of the patients referred to the Al-Gadarif Teaching Hospital and Al-Gadarif Maternity Hospital.
And talk to me about the challenges here at this center, which is sponsored by the Sudanese American Physicians Association. What are the challenges?
The challenges are changing with time. At the beginning of this clinic, the challenge that we faced us, which is the big number of patients, that need urgent medical service, which is not provided at that time. And outbreaks of acute watery diarrhea.
Cholera.
Cholera.
Mm-hmm.
And many pregnant ladies that need pregnancy service and care that not provide. But with collaboration with UNICEF and CAF organization and Gadarif Ministry of Health, we overcame these challenges and move on.
If you had a better opportunity, would you still be here?
If I have better opportunity, I'm still here. Because there's many people that need medical service. We are not treating them up to now.
And why are you not treating them? Why?
There are many challenges that make them out of service. One of the problem, how to access the medical service. There are many people, they don't know how to access the medical service. And shortage of supply in some areas. We are working well with our collaboration with other organizations to solve this problem.
I was going to ask you again, if WHO gives you an opportunity to work with them, would you opt to go for the UN or you will still stay here?
If I get opportunity, maybe I will go with them to provide, to help them in another position.
That is Dr. Musa Abubakar Ibrahim, a health worker at Imshagara Camp B in Gadaref, Jazeera State, Sudan. He spoke to my colleague John Tanza in Gadaref on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization reported over 34,700 new cases of cholera and acute watery diarrhea across 19 countries in January. The African region registered the highest number of cases, followed by the Eastern Mediterranean region and the Southeast Asia region. Cholera spread through contaminated water, causing severe acute watery diarrhea that can be fatal within hours if untreated. Dr. Patrick Otim, Health Emergency Officer for the WHO Africa region, tells VOA's Linoa Mudu that several factors are contributing to the cholera outbreaks in Africa, including conflict, climate change, and poverty.
Cholera, as we say, is a disease of lack. It happens in a context where we have the population doesn't have access to clean water, there are inadequate sanitation facilities, and therefore it thrives in that context. And there are a number of challenges within our region that have been contributing to more or less continuous outbreaks we have had since 2021 within the region. The number one are development issues. As we know, access to water and sanitation is a development issue. The second one is the climate. We have seen adverse climatic events. We have seen droughts in the greater Horn of Africa, but we have also seen cyclones and flooding in the southern parts of Africa. The other issue that is very critical is conflict and displacement. Currently, we have a number of conflicts that are active within the region, and we have seen a number of, you know, when people are displaced, they no longer have access to safe water and sanitation, and therefore cholera thrives in that context.
What are the key gaps in treatment and response that need urgent attention?
We always say as WHO that in this day and age, nobody should be dying from cholera. And that's why we've set a benchmark that in every cholera outbreak, less than 1% of the cases should die. And what is the magic bullet for cholera? It is the rehydration. So ensuring that the person, the fluids that they are losing, you are able to replace it. So the number one issue is the issue of lack of access, immediate access to the rehydration, to the treatment. You need a high amount of oral rehydration solution as well as intravenous fluids. And those intravenous fluids, you need to have them closer to where the populations are so that they can be able to use them. And of course, the clinical expertise.
Cholera vaccine is utilized to prevent cholera. Production has increased to 6.2 million doses, according to report. Yet the demand still outpaces the supplies. What strategy is WHO considering to further boost production?
So the issue that we've had with oral cholera vaccines, which are a very good tool for prevention and control of cholera, has been that we only, as of this year, we still have one manufacturer in Korea that's making the vaccine. So, and there is limited capacity that they can produce in a month. And as you have rightly mentioned, we have a high number of countries that are having outbreaks. So the doses, every time the doses are being produced, they are being shipped out. So we don't even have a stockpile. So the immediate action that was taken initially was to suspend the two-dose strategy, so that now we only use one-dose strategy, so that at least we can spread the doses thin and ensure that the communities that need them are able to receive. But there has been ongoing engagement with manufacturers to be able to boost production. But as a region, we have also been advocating that we need to have manufacturing of oral cholera vaccine within the region, because we are one of the regions that's mostly affected. And we were excited when BioVac in South Africa did announce that they are making investments to be able to enable them to produce the vaccines.
How effective is a one-dose vaccination?
So there have been a number of studies that have been done, and they show that the one-dose strategy is effective. Because, you know, when you get two doses, it gives you protection of at least 3 to 5 years. When you get the one dose, it gives you protection at least 1 year. So it's ideally supposed to be a measure that buys us time so that we address the water and sanitation issue. But it also helps to reduce the severity of the disease and helps us to interrupt transmission. So it's been a very effective tool once we are able to deploy it effectively early in the response and targeted at the hotspots where there are transmission ongoing.
That's Dr. Patrick Otim, Health Emergency Officer, WHO Africa Region, speaking with my colleague Lenoir Modu. Sudan has filed a case at the top United Nations court accusing the United Arab Emirates of breaching the Genocide Convention by arming and funding the rebel paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces in Sudan's deadly war. The International Court of Justice said that Sudan's case, filed on Wednesday, concerns acts allegedly perpetrated by the Rapid Support Forces and allied militias. They include allegations of genocide, murder, rape, forcible displacement, and violation of human rights targeting the country's Masalit people. Sudan alleges that the UAE was complicit in the RSF's actions. Reuters News reports the UAE said it would seek to have the case immediately dismissed and saying it lacked any legal or factual basis. The Sudan Armed Forces and the RSF have been fighting for nearly 2 years. The UN says the conflict has displaced much of the population and left more than half of the country facing dire food shortages. Meanwhile, in Sudan, the UN Children's Agency says armed men are raping and sexually assaulting children, including infants as young as one, amid the nationwide conflict rippling across the country. Joseph English, a UNICEF spokesperson, tells VOA's Caravan Dam that data compiled by gender-based violence service providers in Sudan paint a horrific picture of the sexual violence children are being subjected to.
The stories that we heard from women and children really shone a light on something that receives far too little attention. As we've seen, almost 2 years since the escalation in Sudan, the conflict and the wider humanitarian crisis has created an urgent protection crisis for children. And as you say, with reports of rape and horrific sexual violence, it's infants, children as young as one. We recorded 221 cases of child rape last year, so in 2024. But as we know, with sexual violence in conflict and sexual violence in fragile settings, this is likely just a fraction of the true scale due to the fear and the stigma and the lack of access to services for survivors.
Tell me where this is happening exactly. Is this mostly in El Fasher, these incidents of rape?
So this is really an issue that we see across all parts of the country. Certainly, we know that it is a very real threat to children and to women in those areas where fighting is fiercest, but also that is often the places where people have least access to the critical services in terms of support. We also see this even in areas where, you know, the fighting may not have been as severe, because the wider situation of the conflict just makes people more vulnerable. You know, when people are displaced by fighting, when they're living in displacement camps, even if they are not directly affected by the fighting and the conflict, it raises the risk of gender-based violence, including, you know, sexual violence, including early marriage, and including all of these kind of threats to women and girls.
Is this sexual violence forcing women and girls, and even boys, I guess boys are being raped too, is it forcing women and children to leave their homes?
It is, yes. We certainly see that not even always the direct threat of violence, but the pervasive sense of fear can really be a driver for women and girls, especially, but as you say, also for boys, because our study, the reports that we found that boys made up a third of the victims of the reports of violence. And so it is a very real threat. You know, we continue to see that when people do not feel safe in their home, they are forced to make impossible decisions about leaving and about, you know, going in search of safety, whether that's in displacement camps, whether that's crossing borders to become refugees. So this is certainly one of the factors that is behind people's thinking when they do leave their homes.
I know that UNICEF is still there in many places in Sudan, even though it's dangerous. So what is UNICEF doing to try to help these survivors?
We are, you know, everywhere where we have access, we're working with our partner organizations. And I think it's important to really, highlight the incredible work that local organizations, Sudanese people are doing, establishing safe spaces, integrating gender-based violence services into health clinics, meeting people where they are, and then obviously also providing that medical care and mental health support, because, you know, these kind of attacks have long-term impacts for the survivors. And it's really important that it is not just, you know, immediate care and support that's provided, but long-term. You know, but that's reliant on funding, and that is reliant on our ability to access communities where they are.
That's UNICEF spokesperson Joseph English speaking to my colleague Caro Van Dam from New York. And that's all for this Thursday, March 6, 2025, South Sudan in Focus edition. We now leave you with Jamila by Chameleon. I'm your host, Douglas Impugo, on this live broadcast from Washington. For more information on our programs, log on to voa.africa.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Kelly Williams, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.